Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the December 10th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is a completely black background. It's almost like it's space, and floating in that space are several of the now familiar coronavirus balls with the spikes on them. They all look a little different, with different colors, different spike patterns. And the headline is uh-oh, but the O in that headline is another coronavirus ball. I assume it's the Omicron variant. So we have, uh-oh, will the new Omicron variant elude current vaccines? And not surprisingly, that is our first main story. We'll start right there. Global anxiety rises over Omicron variant. What happened? The discovery of the highly mutated Omicron coronavirus variant sparked alarm around the globe this week as the World Health Organization rated its risk level as very high and scientists raced to assess its potential resistance to existing vaccines. The variant was first reported by scientists in South Africa on November 24th. The first U.S. case was identified in a Californian who'd returned from there on November 22nd and tested positive this week. Cases were identified in at least 20 other countries, including Canada, Britain, France, Germany, Australia, and Israel. Calling Omicron a variant of concern, the WHO beseeched governments to ramp up their vaccination efforts and surveillance of the variant's spread. Japan, Morocco, and Israel closed their borders, while numerous countries, including the U.S., banned flights from southern African nations and are requiring a negative test from all arriving passengers. Prompting the alarm were Omicron's unprecedented 30-plus mutations in its spike proteins, which the virus uses to latch onto human cells. Experts said these mutations could make the variant even more transmissible than the Delta variant and better able to evade immune defenses, both from vaccination and prior infections. The WHO cited preliminary evidence suggesting an increased risk of reinfection to those who've already had COVID. Experts cautioned against panic and stressed that much remains unknown, saying it will be 2 to 4 weeks before testing reveals whether Omicron poses a dangerous new threat. But Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel predicted that existing vaccines would offer significantly less protection against Omicron than against previous variants. All the scientists I've talked to say this is not going to be good, he said. President Biden urged calm, saying the variant was a cause for concern, not a cause for panic. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention strengthened its recommendations on the booster shots, saying that all American adults should get them. Get boosted now, said White House Health Advisor Anthony Fauci. He noted that 60 million eligible Americans have had no shots. Let's get them vaccinated, he said. What the editorial said. The market turmoil that sent the Dow plummeting more than 1,000 points over the last week may be driven more by the fear of new government lockdowns than of the variant itself, said the Wall Street Journal. Facing rising cases, some European countries are returning to pandemic restrictions. But over the past year, we've learned that lockdowns do more harm than good. We need to accept that we're living with an ever-mutating virus, and so do our politicians. So far, vaccinated people infected with Omicron, including the California case, are reporting relatively mild symptoms, said the Baltimore Sun. So if you're not vaccinated, get the jab. If you are, get a booster. Wear a mask in public indoor settings, maintain social distance, and wash your hands frequently. Sound familiar? It should. These proven methods reduce the chance of infection, hospitalization, and death from all known COVID variants, and should continue to serve us well. What the columnist said. How big a threat Omicron poses hinges on three questions, said Brown University Public Health Dean Ashish Jha in the New York Times. Is it more transmissible than Delta, and will it replace it as the dominant variant? Does it cause more severe illness, and will it evade our immune defenses? Early data on transmissibility look worrisome, given the speed of its spread in South Africa. As for immune escape, the mutations are reason for concern, but let's be clear. It is extremely unlikely that Omicron will render the COVID-19 vaccines completely ineffective. Take a deep breath, everyone, said Noah Rothman in commentary.org. Given how little we know about Omicron, why was panic the default response of so much of the news-consuming world? It seems that for an influential few in the media and government, panic has become a lifestyle brand. We owe Omicron to our failure to get life-saving vaccines to every corner of the globe, says Drs. Jay Bott and John Brownstein in ABCnews.com. In low-income countries, just 7% of people have received one dose, compared with 64% in wealthy countries. We were warned that imbalance would allow the virus to spread and increase the chance of dangerous mutations. Now it's happened. Until vaccines are widely available on every continent, variants like Omicron will continue to emerge. We have all the tools to prevail over Omicron, said molecular medicine professor Eric Topol in TheGuardian.com. We just need to use them. We have masks, ventilation, rapid antigen tests, and vaccines that are remarkably potent against hospitalization and death. What's holding us back is our unwillingness and resistance to use all these tools. Resistance that's made the U.S. the world leader in new infections, with more than 90,000 new Delta cases a day. That's our biggest problem, not Omicron. And we'll go over to the second main story this week. Supreme Court signals Roe may fall. What happened? The Supreme Court's conservative majority sent a strong signal that it was willing to pare back the right to abortion and possibly overturn Roe v. Wade entirely during arguments this week about a 2018 Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The Mississippi law had been blocked by lower courts, which said it violated Roe, the 1973 Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion nationwide, and 1992's Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which reaffirmed the right to a termination before fetal viability, currently about 24 weeks. Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart said both rulings were egregiously wrong, and most of the court's six conservatives appeared to agree. Justice Brett Kavanaugh suggested it might be best to return abortion to the states and let the court be neutral on an issue on which the Constitution is silent. Justice Amy Coney Barrett implied that adoption had negated the need for abortion. Only Chief Justice John Roberts seemed to favor a compromise, saying that Mississippi's 15-week ban is not a dramatic departure from viability. The court's three liberals warned of the dangers of a major departure from Supreme Court precedent. Justice Sonia Sotomayor accused Stewart of bringing the challenge solely because of the court's new ideological makeup. Three justices were appointed by former President Trump and asked whether the public's faith in the court could survive the stench of overturning Roe. Justice Stephen Breyer said the public might come to regard justices as politicians, adding, "That's what kills us as an American institution." A ruling which could trigger abortion bans in 12 states if Roe is overturned is expected by next summer. what the editorial said. Conservative justices face a conundrum, said the Wall Street Journal. Do they settle for an incremental ruling that upholds the Mississippi law while leaving Roe and Casey intact? Or do they finally overturn these misguided precedents and risk a political backlash? Though this paper has long supported pre-viability abortion rights, Roe is plainly one of the worst decisions the court ever made. It overturned 50 state laws and made abortion into a pitched political battle that nonetheless could not be settled politically through the ballot box. It's time for the justices to give this matter back to the states and let the people decide. This is a dark time for reproductive freedom in America, said the New York Times. Even if the court rules narrowly, state legislatures have already passed hundreds of restrictions in recent years to discourage women from exercising their right to choose. It's clear that reproductive freedom will not be saved in the courts, but only through a concerted political campaign that translates the public's consistent majority support for abortion rights into victories for pro-choice candidates. What the columnist said. We abortion opponents have had the football pulled away from us before, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. But these arguments went exactly as we hoped. Rejecting attempts at compromise, the Mississippi law's foes reasoned themselves into a corner, offering no basis on which to rule against them without overruling Roe and Casey. And none of the conservative justices, apart from Roberts, seemed particularly sympathetic to preserving the decisions. Barrett and Kavanaugh showed their cards without hesitation, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. Kavanaugh posed an absurd question to the Mississippi Solicitor General, asking whether he thought the court had the power to ban abortion nationwide. Of course, no party asked the court to ban abortion. Kavanaugh is trying to frame the overruling Roe and punting the issue to the states as a reasonable compromise. And it was basically game over after Barrett's comments on adoption. She and Kavanaugh are ready to jettison Roe now. Chief Justice Roberts is unlikely to succeed as a moderating force, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Hardline conservative justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito and the Trump appointees have a majority, and they can go galloping off anywhere they choose. Historic disruptive changes are coming, not just to abortion rights, but also to gun control laws, environmental regulations, and more. The court and the nation will be worse off for it. Controversy of the week is Biden. Why are his approval ratings so low? President Biden is coming off one of the best weeks of his presidency, said David Siders in Politico.com. So why are his poll numbers cratering? Biden's approval rating last week sank to an aggregate poll average of 42% at the very same time that the White House was passing his Build Back Better Act, a $1.5 trillion package of climate action and assistance to American families that 58% of voters say they support. Nor did the public seem to give Biden any credit for the hard infrastructure bill he signed last month, another resoundingly popular 63% piece of historic legislation, or the spring's COVID stimulus package that prevented widespread hardship by putting cash directly into Americans' pockets. The chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan took a lasting toll on Biden's poll numbers, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com, and COVID's distressing comeback isn't helping the public mood. Still, with the economy in full rebound and the unemployment rate falling faster than ever in history, it's hard to understand why a president with such well-liked ideas is so disliked. How is this a mystery, said Rich Lowry in NYPost.com. Biden ran as a moderate, pledging to bring competence back to the White House and a sense of normalcy back to American life. Instead, one disastrous year on, Biden has bungled Afghanistan, created a crisis at the southern border, fueled inflation with wild spending, and appeared bumbling weak and controlled by events. Rather than govern as a caretaker centrist, he's let himself be carried along by the left-wing tide of the party. Voters know that before it was pared down, the Build Back Better bill was a Bernie Sanders wish list, a $3.5 trillion grab bag containing nearly the entirety of the progressive agenda. His defenders can tout the supposed health of the economy all they want, said Con Carroll in WashingtonExaminer.com. All voters know is that food and gas prices are soaring, while the man in the Oval Office is pushing more spending on social issues. If Biden's problem is that he's too liberal, you'd think liberals would like him, said Lisa Lehrer in the New York Times. Instead, the sharpest declines in his approval numbers are among left-leaning voters who feel Biden has failed to make progress on their priorities, voting rights, immigration reform, climate change, and the filibuster. Biden's caught in a big squeeze, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. His party's progressive wing blames him for not advancing their agenda, even though he tried and was blocked by centrist Democrats, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Meanwhile, moderate working-class Democrats, including many black and Latinos, want more police on the streets and a tougher border policy. For Biden and the Democrats, time is running out, and Trump is waiting. In politics, everything can change in a matter of weeks, said Harry Enten in CNN.com, and we really don't have any idea what the political environment will be on Election Day 2024. Historically, a president's approval rating 1 year into his first term has no connection with what it is 3 years later. Swings of 10 points are not uncommon. If gas prices and inflation ease, COVID recedes, and the infrastructure and Build Back Better bills boost the economy and improve people's lives, Biden may rebound. Or unforeseen errors and events could drop his approval even lower. So, to those already handicapping the 2024 Biden-Trump race, I say, stop it. 3 years from now is an eternity. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Xi Jinping after the World Health Organization decided to skip the letters new, N-U, and Z, X-I, in the Greek alphabet and name the new coronavirus variant Omicron. A WHO spokesman explained that new is too easily confounded with new, and Z was not used because it is a common last name. It was a good week for dogs after researchers at Britain's University of Liverpool found that many cats exhibit psychopathic traits, including meanness, disinhibition, pet unfriendliness, and human unfriendliness. It was a good week for Texas after actor and self-described philosopher-poet-statesman Matthew McConaughey announced that after careful consideration, running for Texas governor is a path that I am choosing not to take at this moment. McConaughey advised disappointed fans to just keep living. But it was a bad week for Chris Christie, who after a national tour that included interviews on nearly all the major networks, sold only 2,289 copies of his new book on saving the Republican Party. It was a bad week for true believers after Trump lawyer Lynn Wood released a recording in which retired general and fellow Trump supporter Michael Flynn called QAnon total nonsense. Flynn, who has publicly endorsed QAnon, also allegedly said that the far-right conspiracy theory was invented by the CIA to make people look like a bunch of kooks. Finally, it's a bad week for the sincerest form of flattery. After North Korea banned people from wearing the signature leather trench coats favored by Kim Jong-un. Imitating Kim's look, authorities said, is an impure trend to challenge the authority of the highest dignity. The briefing this week is titled, Legally Rigging Elections. State legislatures are using computer-aided gerrymanders to ensure that the dominant party stays in power. How does gerrymandering work? Under the Constitution, state legislatures redraw congressional districts every 10 years to account for census-documented population changes. To ensure equal representation, these districts must be roughly even in population. But since the early 19th century, legislatures have often engaged in creative boundary drawing to guarantee that most congressional seats will go to the party in control of the legislature. As a simple example, the party in power can take a district in which the opposition draws 50% of the vote and divide it into two, ensuring the minority party will lose both districts. Gerrymandering, named after 19th century Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry, has become far more sophisticated and aggressive in recent years, as consultants armed with algorithms and voter databases have unleashed a frenzy of partisan map-making. In 2012, Democratic candidates for the House received 1.4 million more votes than Republicans, but the GOP came away with a 17-seat advantage. For the 2022 midterms, only 18 states have finalized their maps thus far, but redrawn districts now virtually guarantee that Republicans will flip at least 5 seats. What states do this? It's common practice in the 39 states where state legislatures, as opposed to nonpartisan commissions or other bodies, oversee redistricting. The states in which Democrats control the legislatures aggressively gerrymander. Illinois and Maryland contain some of the most heavily gerrymandered and misshapen congressional districts in the country. But this year, Republicans firmly control 20 state legislatures, including 4 of the 6 states that are gaining congressional seats: Texas, North Carolina, Montana, and Florida. Racial and ethnic minorities who tend to favor Democrats contributed much of that population growth in these states, but Republican gerrymandering will water down their power. Texas owes 95% of its 2010-2020 growth to non-white and Hispanic groups. Only about 40% of the state population now is non-Hispanic white. Yet Republicans' 2022 map added one majority white district to the 22 that currently exist, while eliminating one of its 8 majority Hispanic districts and its only majority black district. Despite Texas' fast-growing non-white population, 538.com rates 24 out of the state's 38 congressional districts likely as Republican strongholds. Is that legal? The Voting Rights Act of 1965 bans gerrymandering designed to hurt racial and ethnic groups, but it does not prohibit gerrymanders for partisan reasons. In 2017, the Supreme Court struck down GOP-controlled North Carolina's initial 2011 map, which heavily favored Republicans based on strong evidence the legislature intended to minimize the influence of black voters. Republicans responded by drawing an even more politically skewed map, which led to another lawsuit. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court's conservative majority ruled in 2019 that regulating partisan gerrymandering was beyond the reach of the federal courts. The ruling enables lawmakers to insist that gerrymandered maps that dilute the power of minorities do so as an unintentional byproduct of drawing lines for partisan advantage. What's happening this year? A massive amount of extreme gerrymandering. The approved 2022 map for North Carolina, a swing state that went for Trump by less than 2 percentage points, would give Republicans 10 of 14 seats. One of the 2 Democratic-leaning seats that was eliminated has been represented by since 2004 by G.K. Butterfield, an African-American congressman. Voting rights advocates have filed 3 lawsuits arguing that the map is so severely gerrymandered that it violates the principle of one person, one vote. In Wisconsin, another narrowly divided swing state, Democratic Governor Tony Evers last month vetoed a proposed map that gave the GOP 6 out of 8 House seats. The job of redistricting now falls to Wisconsin Supreme Court, where conservative justices hold a majority. Can the system be fixed? Yes, in theory, but numerous attempts at reform have failed. In 2018, 75% of voters in Ohio supported amendments to the state constitution that requires the legislature to get some bipartisan support for its redistricting map. Republicans commandeered the process anyway, leaving Democrats with just 2 seats out of 15. Reformers often call for putting redistricting in the hands of an independent or bipartisan commission. 13 states currently do this. But sometimes the results are no less skewed. The latest proposed map in California, which draws its maps via independent commission, gives Democrats 75% of the congressional seats, despite their having just 59% of statewide votes. In the Democrats' proposed Freedom to Vote Act, partisan gerrymandering would be banned nationwide. But that bill has been stymied by a likely Republican filibuster in the Senate. Without support from the Republican and Democratic incumbents who benefit from gerrymandering, efforts to ban it will probably go nowhere. In this crazy system, said New York Public Interest Research Group Executive Director Blair Horner, partisan consideration often rules. We're on to a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Will Garland Let January 6 Plotters Go. Merrick Garland's Justice Department deserves credit for prosecuting Trumpist foot soldiers who stormed the Capitol on January 6, said David Rothkopf, but it's not enough. Federal prosecutors have given no indication they plan to charge Trump or his cronies for their election interference and attempted coup d'etat. With Trump caught on tape demanding that Georgia's Secretary of State find 11,780 votes. Nor have we heard a peep about the DOJ prosecuting the dozen instances of clear obstruction of justice that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report cited against Trump. People who know and respect Garland say he deserves patience and note that grand jury investigations operate in secret. But in a town where everything leaks, we should know by January whether Garland is giving a free pass to Trump and the co-conspirators who blatantly tried to overturn an election. The Attorney General seems obsessed with depoliticizing the DOJ after William Barr weaponized it for Trump. But there is no way to prosecute politicians for crimes committed in the name of partisanship without appearing political. If Garland doesn't hold the coup plotters accountable, they will see the inaction of our justice system as a license to continue their attacks. Taxpayer funding for anti-vaxxers. In an act of pernicious hypocrisy, Republican governors have decided to give welfare to vaccine refusers, said William Salatin. The same governors in Iowa, Tennessee, Florida, and Kansas who cut unemployment benefits to force workers to get off the sidelines now are ensuring payouts to people who lose or can't find jobs because they refuse COVID vaccines. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, for example, criticized supplemental unemployment benefits during the pandemic for paying people to stay home. He ended those payments last summer. But Lee recently signed legislation that pays vaccine refusers to stay home. So did Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who had complained that unemployment benefits created a perverse incentive structure. Now he signed a law that guarantees those benefits to people who refuse to be vaccinated. In fact, the Florida law says that if you're unemployed and you're offered a job that requires vaccination, you can turn it down and stay on the dole. This is how Trump-era Republicans define personal responsibility and limited government. In their new bizarro world, governments should intrude in private employers' workplace policies. Governments should use taxpayer dollars to subsidize freeloaders who endanger their communities. It's the party of socialism for anti-vaxxers. This column comes from South Korea. The perils of speaking Konglish. It's not surprising that South Koreans use many English words in their everyday language, said Kim Jong-un. After all, U.S. troops have been stationed here since the 1950s, and the language of global business and pop culture will always have a certain cachet. What is surprising, though, is that so many of the words we use are awkward or wrong. Instead of cell phone, we say hand phone, and instead of laptop, we say notebook. Contact-free payments are untacked. A steering wheel is a handle. A windshield wiper is a window brush. And a flat tire, a tire punk. A comedian is gag man, pronounced gagumain. No foreigners would understand these words, so American tourists here are often perplexed. And Korean tourists in the U.S. run into trouble when they ask for oil when they mean gasoline. Even Koreans who got top grades in English class are unprepared because the textbooks we use, written by Korean authors, not native speakers, are plagued by outdated 19th century expressions and overly complex grammar that nobody uses anymore. Why don't we teach our students living English so that they can converse with native speakers? They need to learn that Konglish is for domestic use only, not for overseas. The last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Last Exit from Afghanistan. At Kabul's airport, Abbey Gate, one company of Marines made life-and-death decisions about who could evacuate, said Helene Cooper and Eric Schmidt in the New York Times. Then, a suicide bomber struck. The Marines at Abbey Gate were racing against time. The crowd at the gate didn't know it, but the Marines had been told to close it by 6 p.m., That left just 30 minutes for Captain Jeff Ball, 33, commander of the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines Ghost Company, to pluck out a few more people with that elusive combination of affiliation and luck that would get them onto a plane out of Afghanistan. Just 30 more minutes for Corporal Hunter Lopez, 22, to grab another child out of the sewage canal where hundreds jostled. Just 30 minutes for Captain Andres Rodriguez, 31, to scan the crowd for men who fit the descriptions in dozens of text messages from people in the United States trying to save their interpreters. The plan for the final retrograde of the American war in Afghanistan was clear. On August 26, the British troops stationed at nearby Barron Hotel would fall back. A few hours later, the 82nd Airborne would take up the Marines' forward positions, allowing Ghost Company to fold into the terminal. And finally, the 82nd Airborne would fall back to the airport, to waiting planes, ending America's longest war. The Afghans, who had been on their feet for hours, were passing out in the heat from dehydration. They had been coming by bus, car, and foot for 10 straight days, assembling near the Jersey barriers and standing knee-deep in the foul-smelling canal near Abbey Gate, a main entryway to the airport. Lopez saw a little girl getting crushed and plunged into the mass of people to get her. About 5:45 p.m., Ghost Company's Maxton, Doc Soviek, a 22-year-old Navy corpsman, got a call that someone had fainted next to the Jersey barrier. He and another medic went to help. As it turned out, the Marines at Abbey Gate didn't have 30 minutes left. They had 18. A suicide bomber detonated at 5:48 p.m. Captain Jeff Ball, call sign Ghost 6, joined the Marine Corps because he says it didn't feel right having other guys go out and fight while I just sit at home and benefit from their sacrifice without doing anything myself. After growing up in Littleton, Colorado, he got a Bachelor of Arts in International Relations from George Washington University and was commissioned in 2012. He said goodbye to his pregnant wife and deployed to Jordan with Ghost Company in April, his green sea bag filled with 40 books, including Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. On the night of August 12th, Ball, called 6 by his Marines, was on a training exercise in Jordan when he received a text from his gunnery sergeant. "Look at the news right now," it said. The Taliban had captured Kandahar and Herat, Afghanistan's second and third largest cities. The U.S. military had withdrawn from Afghanistan, so President Joe Biden ordered 3,000 troops to Kabul to evacuate Americans. Soon that number would be 5,800. Ball returned to base to the news that Ghost Company would be that Ghost Company of the 2-1, as the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines is known, should be ready to deploy in 96 hours. Ghost Company evolved from 2-1's Ghost Battalion, which earned its name, according to Marine Corps legend, through a history of rapid helicopter assaults in Vietnam that left frustrated North Vietnamese commanders in their wake. Senior commanders often gave the toughest missions to the Ghost of 2-1. On August 18th, 110 Marines of Ghost Company landed at Hamid Karzai International Airport on a tarmac that had been cleared after a tragic melee 2 days earlier, when people surged onto an American warplane's wings and fell from the sky after it took off. The tarmac in the middle of the night was intense but controlled, Ball recalled in an interview with the New York Times at Camp Pendleton, California, where Ghost Company and 2-1 are based. There was rifle fire just outside the airport, and tracers and flares were going up. This was the first time in Afghanistan for Ball, and he would not see the country beyond the airport. The next day, Ghost Company received orders to open Abbey Gate. The Marines hadn't brought any transportation to get around the airport complex, so they hotwired a blue bus nearby. They called it Big Blue. They also took a motorized baggage cart and called it Casper because Ghost Company. Altogether, Ghost Company commandeered 10 vehicles to use at the airport. Arriving at Abbey Gate around midday, the Marines saw thousands of desperate people pressed together. Many had been there for days under the stern watch of Taliban fighters standing on the cars, rifles in their arms. People were yelling and holding up whatever documentation they thought would help get them through. Yellowed letters of appreciation from an army colonel in Kandahar, completion certificates for courses taken with American troops. But before the Marines could start looking at any of the documentation, they had to impose some kind of order. That meant working with British forces and other troops to clear a path from Abbey Gate all the way to the Baron Hotel, where the Afghans were backed up. It was layers, civilians, then Marines, then another layer of civilians, then Marines, Ball said, and we're just pushing each other. It's like we don't know what to do. Ball started wading into the crowd, and Corporal Wyatt Wilson, 23, pulled him back. "No, you don't, Six," he said, before moving into the crowd himself. Ball climbed atop a vehicle to see. There was no pressure release for the crowd, he realized. To impose order, the Marines needed to let some people into Abbey Gate. Once the British troops and the Marines let in around 300 Afghans, corralling them to one side, there was a little space to maneuver. But thousands of people remained, pushing and crying, while the Marines tried to hold their lines. By 5 p.m., as the sun was starting to dip, it became clear there was still no pathway to the gate that wasn't thronged with people. Gunnery Sergeant Brett Tate, a Marine with 2-1's Fox Company, came up with a plan. "Just talk to the Afghans." Ball sent the order down the ranks, then asked an interpreter to relay the message to the Afghans, but the interpreter told him that, "You have to talk. They have to hear you." "Ladies and gentlemen, I need you to move backwards," Ball yelled. "Then we can start processing you tomorrow." but people had been guarding their precious spots at the gate for days. A few of them shifted. Ball kept talking. A few more moved. As Ball walked into the crowd, still talking, Lopez put his hand on his flak jacket. "Grab the six," he said. Soon two other Marines were holding on to Ball as well. "I was pretty nervous to be walking into that crowd," Ball said. "But once they grabbed me, the fear left." Slowly, the Marines walked the crowd backward. For 12 more hours, the Marines worked to clear the path. Late into the night, a British major told Ball that they had to tell the Taliban what they were doing. Before he knew it, Ball was walking to a dark alley behind the Barron Hotel to meet Taliban fighters. "I realize I need to look confident," he said. He tried his best and let the British major do the talking. Soon the Taliban fighters were moving cars out of the way to help the Marines and the British. They worked through the night. At dawn on August 20th, Abbey Gate opened. It had been the most intense 20 hours most of the Ghost Company Marines had ever experienced. And it was only the first day. The Marines were under orders. Anyone in the crowd with one of four golden tickets, American passport, green card, special immigrant visa, yellow badge from the American embassy, or who fit some special nebulous exception that the Biden administration was calling vulnerable Afghans, could be allowed into the airport. But those criteria didn't cover most of the people clamoring to get in, and there were so many people that the Marines often couldn't find the ones who had golden tickets anyway. On top of that, the Marines were inundated with phone calls and text messages from senators in Washington, D.C., Afghan war veterans in California, news organizations and nonprofit groups, all trying to get vulnerable Afghans through the gate. Lopez had joined the Marine Corps just 3 months after he graduated from La Quinta High School in Westminster, California, in 2017. Both of his parents worked for the Riverside County Sheriff's Office, and when he got through basic training, he joined an elite Marine anti-terrorism team before ending up in Ghost Company. At the Kabul airport, Lopez was all over the place, especially when children were involved. At one point, he made it his mission to get an orphaned boy to safety. But the airport orphanage that was being run by the Norwegians was 2.5 miles away. Lopez couldn't find a vehicle. So he put the boy on his shoulders and walked. The boy didn't have shoes when they started out. By the time the two arrived, Lopez had found him a pair. But for every success, there were 10 failures. People who didn't make the State Department criteria and were sent back out. And most of the people who were rejected were sent back out through Abbey Gate, where it was often left to Ghost Company to deliver the bad news. It is very hard to look at a family that doesn't have the proper documentation and then put them back into a sewage canal, Ball said. You're looking at someone who believes that if they don't get out through this airport, that they will be killed by the Taliban. At first, Ball tried to spend time with the rejected families, but as the withdrawal deadline drew nearer, Ball realized he didn't have time to talk to each person who was turned away. I saw everything from calm acceptance to hysteria, he said. One woman in particular is still on his mind. She was miming for him, the Taliban cutting off her nose and her ears, and there was nothing he could do. It had been quietly decided that the gate would close on August 26. The Afghans knew they were up against a deadline, although they didn't know the date. The closer we got to the 31st, the more agitated the crowd is, Ball said. All day long on August 26, he was walking along the Jersey barrier. Ghost Company's entire 1st Platoon was out there, standing next to the canal or backed up against the wall or fetching people from the crowd. Hundreds of people all day were getting crushed against the Jersey barrier. But they kept coming. All day they kept coming. As he spoke of the moments leading up to 5:48 p.m. when the bomb went off, Ball started using present and future tenses, as if to create some emotional distance for himself. The suicide bomber will set up along the canal directly across from us, Ball said. He's got a bomb that produces fragmentation ball bearings. It's directional in the sense that he's able to spray directly into my Marines. He never saw the bomber. Around 75 feet away, he just saw the flash and heard the boom. He probably passed out because the next thing he remembered is yelling, "Get security, get security." He couldn't focus, and then a CS gas canister carried by a downed Marine was punctured by shrapnel and exploded, and he couldn't breathe. Some of Ball's Marines dragged him back to Abbey Gate, and he cleared the tear gas from his lungs and eyes and ran back to help. Nine of Ball's Ghost Company troops were killed, including Lopez, who had snatched the little girl from the sewage canal just before the bombing, and Soviak, the Navy corpsman who was treating someone who had fainted near the gate. Wilson and 13 more injured were flown out for treatment. After the bombing, the surviving members of Ghost Company tried to get through each day. They found jobs for themselves in the passenger terminal at the airport, anything to stay occupied. They flew out of Kabul on August 28th, short 23 people. At a company memorial on September 8th, Ball spoke. "The whole world was watching," the Marine Corps, the Marine captain told his troops. "But the Marines at Abbey Gate, we pulled in 33,000 people, more than at any other gate. We stayed open when other gates closed. We should take pride in that." A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's a short health and science piece. NASA's mission to nudge an asteroid. In the 1998 film Armageddon, Bruce Willis detonates a nuclear bomb inside an asteroid to stop the space rock from smashing into Earth. Last week, NASA launched a $330 million spacecraft with a similar aim, just without the nuke. Willis or the world-ending Jeopardy. The plan is for the 1,200-pound golf cart-sized DART, Double Asteroid Redirection Test craft, to spin around the sun and slam into the asteroid Dimorphos next September at about 15,000 miles per hour. That asteroid, roughly as big as Egypt's Great Pyramid, is currently some 300 million miles from Earth and poses no threat to our planet. But if the collision succeeds in knocking Dimorphos a fraction off course, NASA and other space agencies will know they can deflect future asteroids that do imperil human existence. "This isn't going to destroy the asteroid," mission official Nancy Chabot tells the Washington Post. "It's just going to give it a small nudge." 10 days before impact, DART will release a tiny spacecraft that will photograph and monitor its final progress. Scientists will be watching to see if the asteroid's orbit around Didymos, a much larger asteroid that it circles like a moon, is altered as hoped. Their goal is to shave 10 minutes off the smaller asteroid's almost 12-hour orbit. "We're going to learn an incredible amount," said Lori Glaze, director of NASA's Planetary Science Division, "and be so much more prepared for an asteroid threat in the future." We're on the Talking Points page. The Arbery verdict. What does it tell us? "Maybe there's a glimmer of hope for justice in the United States," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Travis McMichael, his father Greg, and neighbor William Bryan were found guilty of murder, false imprisonment, and aggravated assault by a Brunswick, Georgia jury after chasing and shooting to death Ahmaud Arbery, a young black man jogging in their mostly white neighborhood. It was a classic lynching of the kind white mobs once regularly committed against black Americans with impunity. But this time, a video of the murder was so incriminating, a jury of 11 whites and one black person quickly came with guilty verdicts. "Yes, but don't draw larger conclusions about our criminal justice system from this highly publicized case," said Radley Balko, also in the Post. A 2017 survey by the Marshall Project found that when a white person kills a black person, the killing is about 8 times more likely to be deemed justified than other killings. When no one is watching, our system is still riddled with racial bias. Our system is not perfect, said Tiana Lowe in the Washington Examiner, but it works far better than progressives contend. Even after the McMichaels were convicted, the left couldn't stop complaining about the Kyle Rittenhouse acquittal. In Wisconsin, even though prosecutors found zero evidence of racism or white supremacy in his social media history. Why not celebrate 2 correct verdicts? Sorry, but the truth is that Arbery's killers almost never face charges, said Ilya Samin in Reason.com. The original local prosecutor, Jackie Johnson, ordered police not to arrest the McMichaels. It was only when the video of the shooting was leaked to the media that the McMichaels were charged, and Johnson was indicted for violating her oath of office. This trial could have easily gone the other way, said Leonard Pitts Jr. in the Miami Herald. Defense lawyer Laura Hogue tried to stoke the nearly all-white jury's racial fears, describing Arbery with contempt as a scary, disgusting man who had no socks to cover his long, dirty toenails. In other words, the N-word deserved what he got. After Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, Tamir Rice, and so many other black men were killed without consequences, these convictions gave African Americans a brief feeling of relief. But in America, justice remains elusive, fickle, and unreliable. Democracy, is it in real danger? Democrats are sinking into despair, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. 1 year later, it's become increasingly clear that dislodging Trump has bought American democracy only a brief reprieve. Next November, voters are likely to deliver the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate to a party that largely treats January 6 insurrectionists as heroes. The GOP is using extreme gerrymandering to stack the deck against Democrats in state after state. Trump-aligned Republicans are also laying the groundwork for stealing future elections by purging local officials who stood firm against the big lie and replacing them with apparatchiks. Meanwhile, the GOP increasingly winks at the violent intimidation of its political enemies. It's no wonder that many dispirited progressives are turning off the news and withdrawing. But that's a terrible mistake. If Republicans take the White House in 2024, it's hard to imagine them ever consenting to the peaceful transfer of power again. That may be a real possibility, said Brianna Navarre in USNews.com. In its annual report on global democracy, the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance for the first time listed the U.S. as a backsliding democracy like Hungary and India, noting runaway polarization, efforts to suppress voter participation, and an increasing tendency to contest credible election results. Nonsense, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. The authors cite rollbacks to voting rights as an authoritarian issue, without noting that every European nation has stricter voting requirements, including voter ID, than the most stringent red state. And didn't Democrats spend 4 years attacking Trump's legitimacy with conspiratorial rumors and disinformation about stolen elections? Democrats better start acting like they're fighting for the Republic's future, said Wajahat Ali in the DailyBeast.com. Please, no more naive nonsense from centrists promoting platitudes about bipartisanship. The Republican Party of Reagan and Romney is long dead, said political scientist Brian Klass in the Washington Post. Having studied the rise of authoritarianism around the world, I've seen that parties taking over by autocratic demagogues like Trump reverse course only when they suffer a crushing electoral defeat. But the GOP is likely to be rewarded for its rightward lurch in 2022. The battle for the GOP's soul is over. Trumpian authoritarians have won. And we'll take a few of the short notes. 92% of federal employees and military personnel had received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine by November 22nd, the deadline for vaccination of federal workers set by President Biden. Nearly 5% have asked for exemptions on religious or medical grounds. At least seven doctors who attended an anti-vaccine conference in Florida in November fell ill from COVID soon after. They included Bruce Boros, a 71-year-old cardiologist from Key West, who boasted to hundreds of attendees at the Florida COVID Summit that he and his wife had been taking the dewormer Ivermectin for 16 months and that he'd never felt healthier in my life. And we'll finish out today's show with a quote from Joan Rivers, quoted in Reader's Digest, who says, "People say money is not the key to happiness, but I have always figured if you have enough money, you can have a key made." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.